right, welcome to Rebel Headquarters. Got a couple of great guests for you guys. Boom, we're going right into it. You ready? Joining me now is Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. He ran for governor in Michigan. He was the most progressive candidate in that race. He did not prevail in the primary, but Democrats did prevail in that race overall at the end. So he's on to something new, and we want to talk to him. Abdul, good to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me, Cenk. I'm excited to be on the show.
No problem, brother. So you started a new group, but before we get to that, so you lost in the primary to Whitmer, and then you immediately started attacking her, right?
No. Look, at the end of the day, her opponent was a man by the name of Bill Schuette, who welcomed Donald Trump's endorsement with open arms, has filed 9 lawsuits to try and repeal Medicaid expansion in Michigan, argued in front of a court of law as the attorney general that kids didn't have the right to read. And I knew as many challenges that I had with the eventual Democratic nominee, I knew that Bill Schuette just was not an option for the state of Michigan. I mean, and look, I'm raising a little girl in this state who's ethnically half Egyptian and half Indian. And I know that this is not going to be the kind of state that I want to raise her in under a Bill Schuette governorship. And that's exactly why we turned around immediately. I told my supporters, do not Abdul or bust me. It is time for us to do the work to make sure that Bill Schuette never sees the inside of the state house. And that's exactly what we did.
All right, excellent. So now Democrats have the governorship in Michigan, which is very welcome news. Now, Abdul, you started a new group called Southpaw Michigan, right?
That's right.
I think I get it because you're coming from the left, Southpaw, right?
That's exactly right. A Southpaw punches from the left. Well done.
Okay. I went with pitches from the left, but yes, punches from the left as well. I like that better, much better. First of all, let's figure out what Southpaw is, and then let's talk about what you've already done in that regard. So what is it?
So it's a political action committee focused on big organizing. We always say that the dollars are small, but the people power is big. And we got behind 35 incredible candidates in this general election through the midterm. And then we did everything we can to knock doors and call and text for them. We had about 300 volunteers from my campaign. We sent something like 560,000 texts. We made over 50,000 phone calls, knocked on thousands of doors. And 15 of our candidates prevailed. We also got behind all three ballot petitions, the first to legalize marijuana, the second to end gerrymandering in a state, and the third to provide access to the ballot for people who don't currently have it through things like same-day registration. And all three of those passed. So we're really excited about the work and next steps in terms of how we organize for 2020 and actually even the 2019 elections is what we're looking at now. But we're really excited to have done this. Got a lot of people jazzed who might not have been as excited given my loss in the primary. Back out there, knocking on doors, sending text messages, and making phone calls.
So I want to get two things straight here. So instead of packing up and going home, you took your volunteers and your donors, and you said, can we go help other Democrats in Michigan and other Democratic causes? And by the way, just causes that aren't even necessarily Democratic, like ending the gerrymandering in Michigan. And you helped to get those done. I'm understanding that right.
That's exactly right. Look, a lot of folks wonder if progressives know how to pick up and play ball, and we do. The fact of the matter is that that's exactly what we did after our primary. You know, we have a late primary in Michigan. It took place on August 7th, and we had just under 3 months to get to work. And we're really proud of the work we did, recognizing that there was a lot more to do, even beyond moving me across the finish line. And I'm really thankful for the folks who decided to stay active and stay engaged. Because in the end, you know, democracy is bigger than what jersey you have on, what color you wear. Democracy is what we fight for. And that only happens when people decide to stay engaged, even when their candidate of a choice doesn't win. And I think there's a real opportunity for us to drive that home. And I think we took that. And I'm really proud of the work that not just me, but so many folks who decided to get to work under the Southpaw banner did.
Yeah, no, I love that, man. I love when progressives say, okay, well, we didn't win that one. Guess what? We're getting back up, and we're going to go win those ballot measures, and we're going to win for other progressives in the state, and you guys did. And those you cleaned house on the ballot measures. Some of those were amazing. Ending the gerrymandering was wonderful. But that leads to question number two. You're a doctor, yet you voted to legalize marijuana. I hear that is a very, very dangerous drug. How could you have done that, Dr. El-Sayed?
I'll tell you what. When I was a medical student at Columbia University in New York, I was on my neurology rotation, and I got to help take care of a young boy who had really bad seizures, and the medications that we were offering just wouldn't do the trick, and he kept seizing. And as a last ditch, the doctors decided that they wanted to put him on medical marijuana, and guess what? It worked. Too few people, though, even with legalized medical marijuana, have access to it because of the continued stigma. And so if we want to get this right, number one, we need to legalize for recreational use. And number two, that legalization for recreational use opens the door for understanding how better to use this through high quality research, which we still can't do because marijuana remains illegal in most states. Second, look, this is just generally a civil rights issue. You're 3.3 times as likely to be arrested for marijuana possession in this country if you're black, despite no higher likelihood of possessing marijuana. And that's part of what has led to the incarceration epidemic that we have in this country, and legalizing is part of fixing that. And then the last point I'll make is that nobody wants marijuana in the hands of children, and nobody wants anybody operating heavy machinery under the influence of marijuana, just like alcohol. But the fact of the matter is, because we're so focused on using police resources to police a substance that should not be legal in the first place, we don't actually have the capacity to really focus on those two issues. And I think legalizing is going to be really important to being able to really target the errant use, right? Errant use meaning use by children and use for somebody who's operating heavy machinery or a car. And then the last point I'll just say is it's estimated that our state is up for about $125 million in excise taxes that really could go to fixing things like schools and roads, which are really broken in the state. So it's just a smart policy decision. I, for one, have never used marijuana, but it's not even about that. It's about what is the smart policy decision. We've got to do something about this double standard between alcohol and marijuana, and I'm really proud of our state for doing the right thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I, for one, have used it. You should give it a shot. Okay.
So. I did just lose an election, so maybe it's not a bad idea.
So let's talk about the next election. Are you excited about 2020 and any big ideas surrounding that?
Look, I'll tell you this. I am excited. I will say that we've got a lot of work to do for 2020. I'm somewhat skeptical about whether or not we fulfilled everything we could have in 2018. And then look, in Michigan in particular, there was a blue wave. But in a lot of other states, we didn't perform as well as we could have. And the reason why is because I just don't think we are running on the kind of bold ideas that we need to be driving forward in America in 2018, 2019, 2020. Look, we've got an epidemic right now of underemployment, and our unemployment rate may be an all-time low, but people are stuck working gigs. I, in fact, just met a neighbor who stuck living at his parents' house, paying off student debt, and working two jobs at near minimum wage. I mean, this is just not fair. So being able to really focus on a Green New Deal that helps us address climate change, that helps us address the broken infrastructure in this country and provides folks high quality, well-paying jobs, I think is critical. We've got to do something about crippling tuition debt that too many Americans have to pay. And then, of course, Medicare for all. One of my biggest frustrations with the conversation about healthcare in the lead up to the 2018 midterms was that it became about pre-existing conditions. We can do so much more than just protect the ACA. Everybody can have health care. It can cost us less. We can save small businesses and big businesses money, and we can address the deep misincentives in the healthcare system that leave doctors and patients second to insurance corporations and hospital corporations. We can do a lot better if we're willing to have those big, bold ideas, and we know that there is crossover potential there if we're willing to champion them. And I'm hoping that whoever it is running under the Democratic banner in 2020 is a champion for those big ideas, because I think that's the way we beat Donald Trump.
So, you know, I'm not sure what the purview of Southpaw is in this regard. That's why I want to ask you. So if the Democratic leadership in the House does not propose Medicare for all, even though a majority of the Democrats in the House have co-sponsored Medicare for all, can progressive groups like yours put pressure on them to do the bidding of the majority of great majority of Democratic voters?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's really important for us to remember that Democracy doesn't just happen every 2 years. I mean, it's not just about voting them in. You got to vote them in and then hold them accountable. And that happens the day after they're elected. I sat down with Gretchen Whitmer soon after our primary, and I told her, listen, I'm going to do everything I can to get behind you until November 6th. And then on November 7th, I'm going to do everything I can to hold you accountable. It's the work that organizations like ours have to do to make sure that we are applying pressure to hold elected officials, Democrats or Republicans, to the commitments that they made. But in particular, with respect to Democrats, look, this is the national will, but we know the kind of pressure that they're getting from lobbyists, both for the insurance industry, for the hospital corporations, and we've got to be able to provide people power on the other side to holding them accountable. And so we've got to stop playing this every 2 year game, and we've got to realize that citizen participation in democracy has to happen year round. And I think organizations like Southpaw are well poised to do that.
Yeah, and you know, if the establishment Democrats don't do it, we can bring in a Southpaw from the bullpen. So, all right, everybody, Southpaw MI is in Michigan, southpawmi.com. Dr. Abdul El Sayed, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Cenk, thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
All right. Okay, when we come back, a man who's going to tell us how fascism works. Fascinating. I want to find out. Let's come back. All right, back on Rebel headquarters. Really interesting interview coming up next for you guys. Joining me now is Jason Stanley. He is the author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. He's also a professor of philosophy at Yale University. Professor Stanley, great to have you here on the program.
Thank you very much. An honor to be here.
Thank you. And you've won several awards, including for the book How Propaganda Works. You won the 2016 Prose Award for Philosophy on that. And I have to note this because I think it is relevant to this topic. You're the child of Holocaust survivors?
Yes, my father and mother both were refugees. My father from Berlin and my mother from Poland.
Okay, so there's so many interesting things in the book, including the 10 steps to fascism. But I actually want to talk about something that you say that is potentially controversial, but I find to be really, really interesting, that fascism has always been here. What do you mean by that?
Well, fascism really is composed of different elements, and many of the elements are ones with which we're familiar. I mean, the KKK ideology fundamentally overlaps with documents like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which of course was distributed by Henry Ford in the 1920s, hundreds of thousands of copies. The 1930s in the United States were a very fascist time. It was a time when in 1939, there was a 20,000 person fascist rally in Madison Square Gardens organized by the German-American Bund. Our history of racist laws, Jim Crow laws or anti-miscegenation laws, these were the basis of the Nazi Nuremberg laws. Fascism is a politics of purity, and so there's always laws banning the intermarriage, and there's always sort of shame about intermarriage between the outgroup and the in-group. And the model for that, a worldwide model for that, was our laws against our anti-miscegenation laws. Our 1924 Immigration Act, praised by former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, was for Hitler a model. He repeatedly praises it in Mein Kampf, in his second book. So we influenced European fascism.
So that is really interesting, and so people get offended by the word fascism, right? And they think of just like the neo-Nazis that were small and out of power for a while. But hearing about it in terms of the real effects it had throughout the history of this country is jarring. The anti-miscegenation laws that you referred to, where people of different races couldn't marry one another, that was not ancient history. The Supreme Court overturned that in like 1967 or so?
Yes, the Loving versus Virginia.
Yeah.
67 or 68,
which. Isn't that amazing that there were states in America where you were not allowed to marry a white person if you were black, and vice versa, all the way into the late 1960s.
I don't think it's so amazing because you and I have lived through mass incarceration, which is the which is really horrifying. I mean, 9% of the world's prison population comes from 38 million African Americans. In the 90s, as violent crime was precipitously dropping, the sort of rhetoric of mass incarceration largely directed against young Black men was escalating. So we have this very recent history of vilification of out-groups. Both political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, engaged in harsh racial vilification. We're just seeing that extend to immigrants very recently. But we're familiar with these tactics from very recent times. 25% of the world's prison population is in the United States. So this is very real and it's very now. And if you look at the conditions of our country, the background conditions, they set us up for things like detention camps for immigrants. Americans are already attuned and ready to shut off their empathy for large groups of people. We know that.
Yeah, and you know, there was the comments Hillary Clinton made back in the day about super predators, and that was fairly common back then. And now it's become over the top common in the Republican side, but at least less so on the Democratic side. You're absolutely right that it's been around for a long time. And Ku Klux Klan, the original terrorist in America. I mean, that was the whole point of the Klan, was to terrorize people. Christopher Columbus, the original undocumented immigrant. And the list goes on and on. But you want to talk about fascism. Columbus started it here. Us versus them, which you talk a lot about in the book. So let's get to that. What are the defining characteristics of fascism, you think?
First of all, let's begin with the title of Adolf Hitler's book, My Struggle. And I don't want to, when I talk about Hitler, I don't want to draw too tight analogies. Not every fascist movement ends up in mass genocide. But think about the title of Hitler's book, My Struggle. The title of Hitler's book tells you about the ideology of fascism. Fascism is about is about struggle. It's about winning. It's about domination. And the idea is that that the challenges facing us are too great for individuals to face on their own. And so we need nations to be engaged in struggles against each other. And the goal is that one nation should emerge victoriously from this struggle. So the idea is value comes from struggle. Losers have no value, winners have value, and the challenges facing us are so extreme, we need to be engaged in national struggle, nation versus nation, and we need to win this struggle and become victorious. And so fascism is an ideology based on power and loyalty, and its core is there's a nation that and the members of the nation have value because they've won in this struggle between nations. And the leader represents the nation in the world stage.
Yeah, so that's interesting, because as a progressive, I really have trouble understanding that. And so I have to struggle to figure out how they're thinking. Because when O'Reilly criticizes secular humanists, I just can't understand why being a humanist is a bad thing. That's being pro-human. And so when people say that an American life is worth more than a life in Yemen or Bangladesh, I just don't understand it. But when you frame it in terms of winners and losers and hence we are more valuable, I guess that's the worldview. And that begins to explain it. And that's why I think Hillary Clinton made a terrible mistake, which we tried to address during the campaign in 2016. I did a segment called Loser Donald, where I gave literally 100 different reasons why he was a loser in the 100 days leading up to the election. Because his strength comes from being a winner of those type of, in race wars, identity wars, whatever you want to call it. And they never understood that. So now that he is the president, how does it play out going forward?
The plan going forward, I think one of the plans going forward, we have... We have in countries are always in a battle against their fascist side and their liberal democratic side. And on Veterans Day, I want to remind us, I think we should remember that this country did defeat fascism. This country did defeat European fascism. And we had a fascist movement here, and we successfully fought against it. And by heroism, we overcame it. So I think channeling that history, remembering that American patriotism is patriotism to the values of liberal democracy, liberty and equality. And as you say, liberal democracy is based on the dignity of individual humans. It's based on concepts like human rights. And that's part of our patriotism as Americans that we can channel. We can say it's actually unpatriotic to be nationalist in the way we're being asked to be nationalist. We're the country that actually helped set up, helped defend, and fought against virulent European nationalism, even though our history is implicated in that virulent European nationalism. I think we can channel our best traditions and in the face of these challenges. We just have to remember that patriotism is loyalty to our political values. And our political values do involve exactly the ideals you talk about, which are channeled in our history by movements like the civil rights movement, the recent gay rights movement. These are patriotism to American values, respect for the dignity of all human beings, respect for liberty and equality.
Yeah, so the reality is that the right wing in this country that supports things like fascism and the portion of the right wing that does, and the Confederacy, for example, they back losers. It's greatly ironic that they think they're the winners of history. I got news for you. You know who beat the Confederacy? The United States of America. You know who beat the fascists in Germany? The United States of America.
Exactly.
And so we are very clearly also against fascism in this country and have defeated it several times. So last question, as maybe the most important, is there a tipping point that we need to be concerned about? Because yes, it's always here. Now it's a little bit more ascendant. But is there a point of no return? And how do we know we get there?
Excellent question. So fascism is based on loyalty to the nation and loyalty to the leader. So fascism, as Hannah Arendt reminds us, looks like fascism in power looks like a mafia, because loyalty is the basis for the mafia. So you know that things are going bad when the institutions start sort of rotting out from inside, because they're replaced by loyalists to the leader. So we have to look to our institutions. In liberal democracy, our institutions are devoted to being competent, to fulfilling their mission, to tracking reality. When fascism takes power, there's a couple things to look for. First, the institutions start rotting from inside, because they start being turned into mechanisms of loyalty to the leader. So so Arendt tells us, in fascist moments, the competent people are replaced by cronies, loyalists, family members, that sort of thing. Another sign is loyalty to party over parties. This is an Arendt quote. What Arendt means by this is that when you start to find politicians exhibiting loyalty to their political party over loyalty to the concept of a multi-party democracy, you need to worry. When you start to find politicians running on the basis of their loyalty to the party, that they've done well in eroding the multi-party system and shown their own loyalty to the party, that they have more loyalty to their own political party than they do the multi-party system, that's when you really need to worry. And I think, unfortunately, we're seeing some of these signs, because we've seen multiple Republican candidates run for major offices on the basis of essentially voter suppression.
Yeah. Look, a lot of the books about fascism were obviously written before Donald Trump. You go read those, as well as Professor Stanley's book, and it is haunting. I mean, you see a playbook that was written a long time ago, and we can see it in the news every day playing out. And the tipping point is when those institutions do not hold, and the loyalists for the nationalist leader take over. And man, we're right there. And so this is an amazing time we live in. Previous generations got to be heroes by defeating those fascists. We'll find out what we're made of now. So Professor Stanley, thank you for joining us. The book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
All right, we are out of time. Brett's gonna come in actually. We're gonna talk about two things. How big was the wave? Something you might not have heard about the importance of the victories for the Democrats in this election. And also an interesting story about liberal Hollywood. And I'm curious how conservatives react to movies like The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. I wanna talk about that because I saw it over the weekend and the lessons learned there. TYT.com/join to become a member. Members get the post game and all of our shows. We'll see you there.